Althea Billings. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots talking about his new article. It's called Portland Auditor Investigating Zenith for Lobbying Violations. Public records show Zenith and its PR firm engaged public officials consistently throughout 2022, but did not file lobbying reports. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk through your new piece with us. So this follows reporting you did a few weeks ago, uncovering that Zenith Energy and its PR firm had been courting city officials before this surprise reversal on the land use compatibility statement. Can you give us just a little refresher on what you found in that piece?
Yeah, so despite the fact that city officials said that the land use compatibility statement, which will be referred to as the LUX from here on out, despite city officials saying that that process was like any other process, our reporting a few weeks ago found through public records that there were significant communications between Zenith Energy, its PR firm, PacWest, and city officials and bureau staff within the city throughout 2022. That includes text messages, emails, Zoom meetings. It all kind of centers around this tour on July 29th, during which Zenith and PacWest appeared to convince city officials that Portland could be a renewable fuels hub of the future down at their facilities on the Willamette River.
So now the city auditor is investigating this as unreported lobbying activity. What constitutes lobbying in Portland? What has to be met if these reports haven't been filed?
City lobbying code basically says that in order to preserve the integrity of its decision-making process, lobbying entities that engage in efforts to influence city officials should report those efforts to the public. So lobbying entities for private companies who are attempting to influence city officials have to report this if it meets, you know, essentially if they've spent $1,000 or over $1,000 or have accumulated more than 8 hours lobbying during a calendar quarter. And that includes time spent preparing emails, letters, and preparing for any oral communications with a city official.
And from your reporting and from the complaint that spurred this investigation, is it likely that that's the case, or what's the read on that?
We obtained the complaint, which essentially says that it seems highly unlikely that Zenith or PacWest representatives could have spent any less than 8 hours or $1,000, considering all of the public records that are available during that time frame. You know, that is like per quarter, but in each of those quarters of 2022, there was pretty significant communication going on. So even the complaint says, you know, just the development of a new LUX, the draft of that with, you know, for city officials would have required at least 8 hours of work to be able to do that.
I don't know if I had picked up on prior to this article that you wrote that Zenith was the one that drafted the new permit and what that should look like.
Yeah, I was trying to get to the bottom of that because it seems, you know, out of bounds. There are some special situations during which a company can, in more complicated processes, like call on the Bureau of Development Services to help them with drafting. But that kind of seems like a bit more of a special situation thing. And, you know, in light of public officials, you know, and you know, Commissioner Dan Ryan and Carmen Rubio saying that this process was like any other, it never came up in any of those communications that it is different, but why that would, there was no justification for why they would be drafting their own permit.
Well, in this article, you also write that a coalition of environmental advocates signed a letter to the Department of Environmental Quality urging them to deny the permit. That's kind of where things are right now. They got the LUX permit, Zenith did, from Portland, and now it's in front of the DEQ. What is their justification for the DEQ potentially denying this permit?
Yeah, some familiar names in the local, you know, fight over Zenith and other, you know, environmental things going on. Sent a letter to DEQ Columbia Riverkeeper, Willamette Riverkeepers, who have independently sued Zenith in the past, Breach Collective, Portland Harbor Community Coalition, and the Portland Audubon Society all signed onto this letter, basically saying that the process to Zenith's Lux was not sufficient and had some irregularities. And so the coalition wants DEQ to use its legal authority, which is listed on the Secretary of State's website pretty plainly, that if the Lux process was insufficient, they have the right to deny the air contaminant permit. This was a huge thing in the Portland Youth Climate Strike last week. They had two demands. One was that Tina Kotek declares a statewide climate emergency, and the other one is that DEQ denies the air contaminant permit.
So, right, these concerns from environmental advocates and the students who went on a climate strike on September 15th, they're not unfounded. What are some of the risks of Zenith's business and expansion in the CEI hub in Northwest?
Yeah, this has been reported on a lot with regard to traditional fossil fuels. You know, the danger of oil by rail explosions or spilling into, you know, BIPOC communities is significant. The chances of, you know, during an earthquake with oil spilling into the Willamette River or the CEI hub, you know, essentially exploding in the event of an earthquake still exists. And then just, you know, for climate activists, it's a matter of, you know, carbon emissions, and carbon emissions lead to catastrophic climate change. And if it isn't materially reducing those emissions, you know, it's not materially doing anything. So those are all still roughly the exact same when it comes to renewable fuels, which is a bit of a greenwashing term.
What kind of consequences might Zenith or city officials face if this auditor investigation finds that it was a lobbying violation?
I think for the city commissioners, it's maybe more of an ethics issue. And I think the auditor's office is more looking into the lobbying, which has more to do with the companies. So there are some, you know, they can fine Zenith. Within the last few years, there have been, you know, a few of these with the ShotSpotter recently, where they found, you know, insufficient evidence. Portland Metro Chamber, formerly the Portland Business Alliance, was fined a few years ago, like $450. And then the most significant fine in the last few years was in 2016, when Uber was fined $2,000 for a whole host of violations. So they're not significant, but, you know, the auditor's office should keep us in the loop, and I'll be curious to hear what happens.
Would a lobbying violation be an indicator of the insufficient process that these environmental advocates wrote of in their letter to the DEQ?
I think that is at least the argument, from what I've heard from these advocates and from reading through their letter, that the public involvement in the process, which, you know, in a previous city council, there was some public involvement in that process. And that's why in August of 2021, the Lux was initially denied. And then with a more industry-friendly city council, it appears now, that public process has been, you know, closed off. And so that, you know, these advocates believe that it is an insufficient process. I should say the DEQ noted that there will be a 35-day public comment period before they could actually issue that permit, the air contaminant permit.
When does that start?
They have a few things left, and then I think that would come, an announcement would come later, and then the 35 days would start. So I'm not totally sure yet.
What do you hope readers get from this story?
I think it's really interesting that fossil fuel companies are right here in our community and doing a lot of the same tricks that we've seen from the fossil fuel company, from any fossil fuel company, you know, since the advent of oil. So I think it's very interesting that this is happening right in our own backyard. It's right on our Willamette River, and that people are able to get to city officials, that, you know, the public has a hard time communicating with city officials in this capacity. So we'll see. This might be the next thing in a long line of serious violations of city and state code.
Yeah, well, they have a history of that, don't they?
They have a significant history of that. This would be one of the first times that they might actually be adhering to the rules if the auditor finds them that they didn't violate any rules. In 2018, Zenith applied for a permit to add 32 new rail spots, and they, at that time, they promised EQ that they would have no new oil throughput, no increase in emissions or pollutants. But every year since shows a steady increase since 2019. That's directly a DEQ issue, which means to me shows that, you know, DEQ might consider that Zenith isn't being forthcoming. They've failed to pay franchise fees in 2018. DEQ has fined them in the past. They have a bit of a fraught relationship. You know, they've been fined $25,000 for what DEQ called flagrant violations of its air permit. And then they've been independently sued by, you know, some of the same names that we see coming up now, Willamette and Columbia Riverkeepers. And they had to pay, you know, $115,000 settlement to the Portland Audubon Society. It's a long list.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find a copy of your story for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy it from a vendor. They're in your neighborhood, and they accept Venmo, they accept cash and tips. And it's also available, this story is already available online at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts? Anything we didn't cover?
No, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. That was Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots talking with me about his new article. It's called Portland Auditor Investigating Zenith for Lobbying Violations. Public records show Zenith and its PR firm engaged public officials consistently throughout 2022, but did not file lobbying reports. More information is available at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. Some 13,000 auto workers walked off the job in mid-September in the first ever simultaneous strike at the big three automakers, and union leaders say the strike could be expanded if they don't see any progress at the bargaining table. In the first half of this year, the big three have reported a combined $21 billion in profit. That's in addition to the $250 billion in profit over the last 10 years. The workers want a pay raise that would at least approach 40%. Maximilian Alvarez is the editor-in-chief of the Real News Network and the author of The Work of Living. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
The big three are going out at the same time, and this is a big deal. And for years, the labor movement has been criticized for being a little tame, for conducting one-day strikes and not really threatening the employers very much. But how would you characterize this? Is this like a major leap from what they've been doing?
I think it is a major leap in more ways than one, as you already mentioned. You know, we're talking about a labor movement that has been in a seemingly terminal decline for my entire lifetime, right? I mean, union density, meaning the percentage of American workers that belong to a union, has been going down steadily and precipitously for the past half century, to the point where we are just barely hovering above 10% union density in the country. Dismal union density numbers in the private sector. And this is after, you know, years and decades of deindustrialization, which the auto industry has felt acutely. We all know what happened in places like Flint, Lordstown, the Belvedere plant in Illinois. I mean, this has just been happening regularly for years, if not decades. At the same time, you have also had, as you mentioned, a labor movement that has been on its back foot and that has also been in a defensive posture. And that, you know, has really been to the detriment of union members, by and large across the board. The UAW is a great example of this, right? Not only has the UAW experienced, you know, significant job losses with plants closing, jobs offshored, so on and so forth, but that was always the threat that these automakers could make to union workers in the auto industry. And as we saw, it was a credible threat. And so that put labor on the back foot to the point that, you know, past administrations have, you know, typically felt that they can't push too hard at the bargaining table for fear that their members will end up the next Flint, right? And so you mix that in with also, let's be honest, the UAW leadership has been plagued by corruption. A federal investigation, a years-long federal investigation, recently concluded with multiple members of multiple former UAW leaders, including two former UAW presidents, ending up in prison. Now, that was where we were just a couple years ago, right before COVID. And then, like, something miraculous started to happen. You saw UAW members have an opportunity to pass a referendum that would give them a one member, one vote, more democratic system to directly elect their union leadership, which not every union has. And they used that new power after passing that referendum to vote in current UAW President Sean Fain and a reform slate.
This is a departure from Leonard Woodcock, Owen Beaver, Doug Frazier, I don't know them all, but that sort of group that came out of the Reuther era.
This is quite a departure. I mean, before one member, one vote was instituted at the UAW, you effectively had a one-party rule for the past 70 years. Now, that's not to say that the union leadership and its philosophy was homogenous throughout those 70 years, but as you rightly mentioned, you know, this was the dominant paradigm within the union, and any hopes to reform the union from the inside out. You know, generations of auto workers have seen their careers come and go, hoping that something like what we are currently witnessing now would come to fruition. And after the UAW membership voted in Sean Fain, backed by the Reform Caucus, Unite All Workers for Democracy, which is very similar to Teamsters for a Democratic Union within the Teamsters, who backed current Teamsters President Sean O'Brien and his reform administration, you're seeing a lot of new energy. You're seeing a lot of life being breathed back into this union that has been beaten down by job losses, plant closures, union corruption, corporate greed from the top on down. And folks are ready to fight. I've been interviewing workers for my podcast, Working People, for Real News and for Breaking Points leading up to this strike. Auto workers at all three of the different big three automakers. And that's what they've been telling me. They said that, you know, they have seen, you know, their brothers and sisters in the union lose faith in their union leadership and lose faith in any hope that things could be different, and that they were just in for more concessionary bargaining, more playing on the back foot. And now it feels like it's a new day in the UAW. And Sean Fain has really, I think, embodied that new spirit, not just by, as you rightly mentioned, calling for the first time in the UAW's history a strike that involves workers at all three of the big three automakers, that's Ford, GM, and Stellantis, to strike at the same time. Now, they are also, the UAW is employing a novel tactic called the stand-up
strike. This is an open-ended strike.
It is an open-ended strike. Negotiations, we're recording this on Friday, September 15th. Workers at three different locals and three different plants in Missouri, Michigan, and Ohio walked off the job at midnight last night. Negotiations are set to resume this weekend, but Sean Fain, president of the UAW, has said very clearly that even though these three UAW locals were called upon to stand up and hit the picket line first, more could be coming. And in fact, an all-out strike is still on the table if the big three don't get serious at the bargaining table.
Any chance that Sean Fain could end up like Ron Kerry, in other words, a reform leader who is himself accused of corruption, even though in Kerry's case he might not have been personally involved? Do you see any chance of that?
I mean, there's always a chance, but I think that the best that you can do to avoid corruption is, what do they say? Sunlight is the best disinfectant. right? Democratic accountability is the best antidote to corruption in any institution, whether you're talking about a police department, whether you're talking about the House of Representatives, or whether you're talking about a Fortune 500 company. If the leadership and the hierarchy that is created leaves no room for democratic accountability from the people at the bottom to regulate and hold accountable the people at the top, you're going to get corruption. I mean, I think before I did this job, you know, I was an academic trained historian. I've seen it in socialist countries. I've seen it in fascist countries. When you lack democratic accountability, you create the conditions for power consolidation and corruption, which is why I think Sean Fain has been so rightly adamant about being as transparent as possible with his membership throughout this bargaining process. He has not played into the tradition of bargaining between the UAW and the Big Three, symbolically represented in his refusal to partake in the official ceremony at the beginning of negotiations where you shake hands with the CEOs of the Big Three. He refused to do that. Instead, he went out and greeted members at a union local. He has been giving public updates on Facebook Live, being very transparent with his members about what is happening at the bargaining table. And he has been trying to, instead of just telling the membership what they need to do while the leadership sort of hashes out this strategy in secret, and they've been really trying to harness the power of the rank and file. And you can only do that by getting faith from the rank and file in you, by being transparent, by doing what you say, by sticking to your word and showing that you will go to the mat for your members. And I think so far Sean Fain has done that.
Am I remembering right that when the UAW negotiates, it kind of starts the whole season of negotiations that goes on with other unions? Is that still true?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the calendar has kind of all been upended now, because we are seeing more workers in more non-traditional industries go on strike or try to unionize. So,
I was going to mention before when you were lamenting the decline of the union movement, you do have janitors organizing and Starbucks and, you know, people in the service industries and the public sector. That's true.
Right. Let's not forget, the UAW is joining a strike wave. Like, I know everyone was sort of disappointed or felt the kind of let down because we did not see 340,000 UPS Teamsters go on strike in August. But you have to understand, to anyone listening, that like, this is all part of a continuum. This is all part of a working class struggle that is building every time, we get victories, every time we see our fellow workers in different industries take that bold step to say enough is enough, we are worth more than this. And we have been seeing that, of course, in Hollywood. The writers and the actors with the Writers Guild of America and SAG-AFTRA are still on strike. Journalists at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette are approaching 1 year on strike, and they're represented, all the folks on strike at the Post-Gazette are represented by five different unions. Tens of thousands of Kaiser Permanente healthcare workers have voted to authorize a strike and could be on the picket line by the end of this month. At the same time, Unite Here hotel workers across Los Angeles, as my colleague Mel Buer has reported, they've been on strike as well. I mean, like, something's really happening here.
As far as the issues involved in the UAW strike, the members are looking at the profits that the companies have made and feel like they should have a share of that. And that's sort of traditional, but are they going to go after what's normally considered a management prerogative, that is certain working conditions like the speed of the line, for example?
I believe so. When I've interviewed workers leading up to this strike, you know, I got to tell you, like, that's probably been the thing that they have brought up the most. And I really want to impress that upon folks who are listening to this. Like, don't listen to me. Go listen to the workers that I interview. They're all there for you at Breaking Points, at The Real News, and at Working People. But also, you can go check out the great reporting that's been done by outlets like Labor Notes and In These Times. They've been covering rank and file voices in this struggle for many weeks, if not months at this point. But yeah, for me, when I interview workers, they constantly talk about the speed ups. They talk about the, you know, like, what that does to your body to be doing repetitive motions at sped up paces. Not only that, but we're talking people who are working 10, 11, 12 hour days, sometimes 7 days a week, sometimes months without an actual break. And, you know, this is after working through a pandemic. And over the course of the past few years, workers have made these companies more profitable than they've ever been. We're not talking about the same auto industry that had to get bailed out by the American taxpayers to the tune of $80 billion in 2008. We're talking about an auto industry that is now raking in record profits. GM is paying its CEO, Mary Barra, $29 million a year, to say nothing of all the stock buybacks and shareholder dividends. No folks out there are thinking, well, the cost of cars keeps going up, and how could these workers be demanding higher wages? Isn't that going to mean higher prices for me if I'm trying to buy a new car? No, in fact, it doesn't, because workers' wages across the UAW have been in decline. And yet the CEO pay, the executive pay, the shareholder, the stock buybacks and shareholder dividends, these have all been going up. So the people who are putting the higher costs on you are not the workers. It's the greedy corporate executives. And the workers are the ones who are fighting for their fair share, the profits that they have generated for these companies after saving these companies from total collapse 15 years ago during the financial recession. So in many ways, this is, as Sean Fain himself has said, you know, there's a larger dimension to this. It's not just about the auto industry. This is about, you know, the working class coming back to get what has been taken from us. What, you know, to get back what we were promised after we made the sacrifices that were necessary during the Great Recession, but also during COVID-19, when we were hailed as essential workers. All the while, we risked our lives. We risked the lives and safety of our families as GM workers, Ford workers, and Stellantis workers did as well. I've talked to people who knew co-workers who died and never came back, right? After all that sacrifice, what have workers gotten over these past years? We've seen more plant shuttering. Even when these companies are profitable, we've seen them try to convert to EV and green technology and sort of like the electronic car revolution. But they have been like making battery plants and so on and so forth, where the wages are significantly lower than they are in the auto plants. So the UAW is not only fighting to ensure that their workers in the current auto industry get the wage gains, get the benefits like cost of living raises to account for inflation, like going back to a defined benefit pension instead of a 401k, like increases in retirement benefits for retirees who have not seen an increase in their benefits for like two decades. And so there are UAW members who gave their entire lives to these companies, whose bodies have been broken by decades of work, who are living on poverty wages because the companies have not allowed them to get increases in their retiree benefits. So it's a whole collection of things, like ensuring the transition to electronic vehicles has strong worker protections in those plants and good solid wages and good union jobs in those plants. It's about making sure that workers have better pay and benefits to reflect, you know, the work that they do, the profits that they generate, the labor that is asked of them when they are working so long and so hard and sacrificing so many years of their lives to make these companies profitable. But, you know, Sean Fain has also said very clearly that, you know, this is an audacious list of demands that they are making, because he has also put at the bargaining table a demand for a 32-hour work week, right? You know, like he is like really going for the jugular here. And I think it is forcing a conversation in the American discourse over, you know, like how long can we keep going down this route when working people are working harder and longer and sacrificing more, and yet we are seeing our take-home pay go down while the cost of living goes up, while the cost of goods goes up, while it's hard to get housing or healthcare, and yet the CEO class, the executive class, the C-suite class, the shareholder class, they are all raking in record profits. Something's got to give here.
That's Real News Editor-in-Chief Maximilian Alvarez speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KBOO News in Depth. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Stories I've Told the Stars, Friday, September 22nd, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts in Portland. Stories I've Told the Stars is a short documentary that features the stories of three men who left their homes in Ethiopia in the 80s to escape civil war. They share stories of their experiences as refugees, their journey to the United States, and their resettlement in the Pacific Northwest. Stories I've Told the Stars will show Friday, September 22nd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts, 511 Northwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right